For the past 5 weeks, we've been looking at raising right-side-up kids in an upside-down world and recognize that there's just a whole lot of challenges that we face in our particular culture when it comes to parenting. I hope in the process, those of you who don't have kids have been thinking about how the world shapes our culture, how the world shapes you, and your role in just this collective humanity thing that we got going on here, and how you can be an encouragement and support to other people. For those of you who have kids that are grown and gone, hope there's not too much of that feeling of, oh man, I wish I would have heard this a long time ago. Because you know, for you, there's always the grandkids. So be prepared for them. For those of you who have kids now, making change in your family dynamics is one of the most difficult and most exciting things to consider. So I would encourage you, wrestle down these things, particularly the particular topic we're going to be talking about this week. And before we dive into it, let me just say that where we go from here, and we're going to have some very interesting things coming up this fall. Part of our theme for the year, becoming a community for the community, we've looked at what it means to become a community. That is, to become, in my personal growth, something that I have to offer salt and light. And as a church, that we have the kind of relationships that we need. And as families and as individuals, we have the kind of relationships we need. But we need to have those things, not just to make our lives better, but we have something now to offer to the community. So for the next 3 weeks, we're going to look at what does it mean to live in this community? What does the Bible have to say about what it means for me to be a citizen, for me to interact with the various people that God has put around me, for me to relate to this place, this geography, and these people that are all around me? And then we're going to move into a series on work life. Everybody here, whether you're a student, whether you're a stay-at-home homemaker, whether you're going into the corporate world, whether you're doing blue-collar type stuff, regardless of what it is, every one of us has a life outside of this place Monday through Friday. And what does that look like? And what does the Bible say that that life is supposed to look like as we go out into the community and live our lives according to the principles of God? Now, we had an experience that is probably typical to many that you guys have had. When our kids were young, we decided that we were going to stay in the area and do the San Antonio deal. So we'd spent a full day at Fiesta, Texas. And our kids were young at the time. In fact, we only had three of our four. Sam wasn't born yet. We just had a blast. We just went, you know, eat the junk food, ride the rides, sit in the hot sun, have all the fun you can stand. We spent the night. We came back, and we were at Schlitterbahn the next day, just getting completely soggy, you know, waterlogged out there, whipping up and down the rides. And, you know, our kids, you know, Ellen was a toddler at the time. Our kids are just having a blast, but you know, we get in the car finally to come home, and the fatigue factor is beginning to set in, and the crankiness quotient is starting to elevate in our vehicle. And as we're starting to get there, one of the kids says, "Well, now what's next?" Can't be all. Just one lousy, measly day at Fiesta, Texas, and one just lousy, simple, little measly day at Schlitterbahn. What's next? And I said, "We're going home." Now, Ellen is sitting in the seat, and she's, you know, this toddler, got her seatbelt on. She's having trouble keeping her eyes open from exhaustion. And this is no lie, telling you the truth, is she is tipping over in the seat, falling asleep. The last words out of her mouth were, "I don't want to go home." Boom. She landed on the seat, sound asleep. Entertaining our kids is almost a full-time job. Because the appetite for entertainment grows in proportion to the amount of entertainment they consume. And we know that. But hey, let's face it, childhood is supposed to be a fun time. And so the more fun, the more experiences, the more enjoyment that they could possibly have. I mean, what kind of a cranky, crabby parent wouldn't just lavish all the fun on their kids that they possibly can. Give them it. Give them the fun. At the same time, we're also wrestling with this other dilemma as parents because, you know, we've told our kids that they can be and do anything they want to do. I mean, like, every one of them is a superstar. Every one of them is great. I mean, they can be, they can do, they can fly, they can soar. I mean, they're awesome. So there's this feeling in the background that, you know, if my kid wants to try something, I certainly need to give them the opportunity to try, because if they don't get the opportunity to try, how do I know? I mean, I might have the next Roger Clemente growing up in my home. So I've got to get my kid into baseball to see if that's going to be their thing, or soccer, or football, or volleyball, or basketball, or lacrosse. And then, you know, of course, what if my child's the next American Idol? And so, you know, I mean, maybe they can dance. So, you know, we got tap, and we got jazz, and we got ballet, and then maybe they can sing, or maybe they can play an instrument. So, you know, you get the two-year-old, get the bassoon, and, you know, got to get them started. And then there's academics. And it seems like if I want to be a good parent, then I need to invest as much as I can to get my kids involved in as many things as they can, to explore as much as they want to, so that I can determine just what's their deal. Now, what kind of a good parent would withhold those opportunities from Junior? So we live in a world where fun experiences, that's priority for children. We live in a world where growth experiences, that's priority for children. That's why Andy Stanley, pastor of North Point Church, puts it this way. He says, our kids are experience rich, but relationship poor. Experience rich, but relationship poor. Have we ever taken the time to think about the cost of these frenetic lives that our children are living? When a child grows up in a home where the idea of unstructured play would never cross their mind, because unstructured play could never be as fun as Nintendo, where family time consists of watching something stimulating on the big screen in front of the entertainment system, where normal activity is practice, practice, play. Practice, practice, play. Practice, practice, play. Over and over again, day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year, from one season to the next. What is the cost of that? One of the things that's always interesting if you study the history of America, not only is our government an experiment that's been tried and proven to be pretty darn good, I must say, but our social environment is constantly an experiment. And every generation is forging a new path. But oftentimes we don't stop and look at the impact of that path. Some people have started to do that. Let me just give you a little bit of background on some of the experts. Chap Clark has written a book called Hurt. And he believes that as much as the parents of this world are involved in their kids' life, there is a sense of relational abandonment that most teenagers are experiencing today. And Chap's got a great book. He's written a lot on the topic. Let me just read a little bit of what he says. He starts out with some examples. He says this. He says, first example, family with 8 and 9-year-old boys pay hundreds, if not thousands of dollars to spend Thanksgiving weekend traveling so that their boys can, quote, have the opportunity of a lifetime, unquote, to play in a contrived, skillfully marketed, peewee football mythical national championship. I mean, if my 8-year-old has a chance to play in the national championship, it's interesting when you get all these kids from the same town, all playing in different conferences, they're all going to the national championship. Who comes up with these things? Somebody does. Second example he gives, an 8-year-old who loves to dance is no longer allowed to attend a class she loves for its fun, free, raucous, hour-and-a-half adventure in tights. Her dancing now consists of up to 6 or more hours of training, repetition, and practice per week, cultivating in something called a, quote, dance competition, unquote, a phrase that was formerly an artistic oxymoron. How can artistry and competition go hand in hand? We don't even think that way anymore because everything is a competition in our world. Third example, parental fistfights erupt during a 7-year-old t-ball game, in which I was later told is an intensive competitive atmosphere because it is, after all, competitive t-ball. Sign your kid up for the competitive t-ball league. You just got to expect this behavior out of parents. Fourth example, high school junior who arrives home from school promptly at 5:30 after volleyball practice begins a 4 to 6 hour nightly ordeal called homework. On an average night, she has dinner over a textbook, which allows her to avoid conversation with her mom, and falls asleep exhausted at midnight, only to rise the next morning at 5:30 for band practice and for her 7 a.m. AP calculus class. To this, Chap writes, what is interesting is that many adults will highlight these and other activities as proof of their commitment to the young. Quote, I drive my kids to all of these activities. I sacrifice my own life, work, avocation, and enjoyment in order to take the kids to soccer games, concerts, and competitions. Unquote. This statement is in of itself yet another subtle form of abandonment. We have evolved to the point where we believe driving is support, being active is love, and providing any and every opportunity is selfless nurture. We are a culture that has forgotten how to be together. We have lost the ability to spend unstructured downtime. In their book, The Overscheduled Child, Rosenfield and Nicole Wise say it this way. They say the life of pressure and perpetual motion, the very essence of hyperparenting, is giving this generation a generation-wide headache. It makes us feel tired and inadequate because no matter how much we have already done, we could always be doing more. Now, there's always SeaWorld. We just hit Fiesta, Texas, and Schlitterbahn. What about SeaWorld? What kind of a parent am I? Guilt and anxiety become our constant companion. It's too demanding a way to live, and it doesn't make our kids, the ones we are doing it all for, feel so great either. They feel anxious about needing so much, annoyed that we are resenting them for needing it, and perplexed about how to make us happy, which, when it comes right down to it, really ought not be their job either. Winning the baseball championship, which will make Dad happy and proud, is not the job of a 9-year-old girl. It's just not her job. One 13-year-old girl confided in an adult friend that she felt sad and lonely, that her mother never had any time for her. The friend was surprised to hear this. This child's mother was one of the most involved parents he knew. She attended every school function, every sports practice, every game. He'd even seen her at the garden center helping each of her 4 children pick out the flowers, fruit, and vegetables for the individual garden she was helping them to plant in the early spring. Yes, her mom did lots of things with the children, the girl conceded, but she was always frazzled and crabby, irritated at one or the other of the kids for doing something they shouldn't have. What she really wanted, she told him, was just some time alone with her mom. Just some conversation and cuddling that would have meant that she herself was especially loved. But there was never any time for that. Never any downtime. Never any extra time for those kinds of things. We live in a world where scheduling our time and we're scheduling our children's lives is very much the norm. That's very much the norm. The question is, what happens to the relationships? Because if children don't learn to develop relationships with those people that they come up with, that they grow up with, Where are they going to learn those things? Where are they going to learn those things? By the way, we've got a ton of resources on culture, on dealing with kids, on media, on all kinds of stuff on our website. If you'll go to our website, hcbc.com, and look under the student page and go to the section on parental resources, there's just tons of stuff. We don't agree with everything we put out there. Read wisely. But there's a lot of information available to you, like this stuff, that you can get your hands on. We asked the question, why are relationships so important? And very quickly, let me give you three reasons why relationships are so important. And most of these are just self-evident to us. The first reason that relationships are so important is because relationships create influence. Relationships between mom and dad and the children create a powerful influence in the child's life. When it matters most, the quality of your relationship with your children will determine the weight of your impact on your children. When children are facing a decision, do I choose my peer group? Do I choose what's in the media? Do I choose what makes me happy? Do I choose God's plan for my life? When a child is in the process of wrestling with that, and they're influenced from all those directions, the weight of your influence is not on your ability to raise your voice. It's not on your ability to remove things from your child's life. It's not on your ability to demand compliance. The weight is on the ability of your child to trust and love you because they know you. They know you love them. They know you're investing in them personally. They know you understand them, and they know you care deeply for them. That's where influence comes from. It comes from a relationship. Secondly, relationships teach relational skills. Relationships teach relational skills. There are so many experiences that don't teach anything but self-absorbed fun. There are some experiences that do teach winning and losing, and they do teach teamwork. And those have value. But the key to understanding real relationships is to see them, to feel them, to taste them, and to smell them. And so a child grows up and primarily gets their cues for how people relate by watching the adults in their life. Our culture knows this. John Mayer performed a song a few years ago that speaks to the issue of daughters. I love this. Guys, you guys can relate to this song. He starts out this with these words. He says, "I know a girl. She puts the color inside of my world. But she's just like a maze where all of the walls all continually change." Guys, have you ever had that experience? Trying to figure her out? Can't figure her out? He says, "And I've done all that I can to stand on her steps with my heart in my hand. But now I'm starting to see maybe it's got nothing to do with me. Maybe the complex issues in her life have nothing to do with me." And then he identifies where they come from. He says, "Fathers, be good to your daughters. Daughters will love like you do. Girls become lovers who turn into mothers. So mothers, be good to your daughters too." Many an individual has tried to have a relationship with someone else, and they think, well, the reason why this person's relating this way is because of me. It probably has nothing to do with you. It has a lot to do with the adults in this child's life when they were growing up. We learn relationship by living in relationship. Finally, the third, relationships provide joy. Relationships provide joy. And we know this. We know this. It's so funny when you think about the things in life that you remember. You know, the experiences in life that you remember, that you talk about, are most frequently the bad experiences, not the fun experiences. You remember when you and the kids, y'all went camping together, and the thunderstorm came, and the water started washing through the campsite, and it washed, broke the tent down, and washed all your stuff into the stream, and you found yourself sitting in the back of the SUV, shivering and freezing to death. And 10 years from now, you're still telling that story. And everybody's sitting there talking and laughing around the dinner table and sharing about, yeah, that was so wild. That's what people remember. The things that are just fun. I mean, most of those things get forgotten. Most of those things get forgotten. The achievements of life. So many of those things become dust in the trophy case. And let me tell you, as people get older, you know what you want? You want your kids to pick up the phone and call you and say, hey, Dad, let me tell you what happened at work today. How would you handle this situation? Or, hey, Dad, you know you love to fish. Hey, I've scheduled my vacation so that we can spend a few days together, just you and me hanging out. Or, hey, Mom, I want you to be the first one to know we're pregnant. That's what people want. That's what you want. All of the trophies, they're insignificant because joy comes from our connection to one another, our relationship with each other. Well, since that's so obvious, why is it that we tend to put experiences over relationships? The reason is because relationships are difficult. Relationships are difficult. I'm going to share with you two reasons why relationships are difficult. If you'll open your Bibles to Deuteronomy chapter 11. Deuteronomy chapter 11. I want you to turn there. While you're turning to Deuteronomy chapter 11, let me just ask you, parents, what's your number one most precious commodity? What's your number one most precious commodity? I mean, almost everybody would say time. Almost everybody would say time. I feel so busy. I feel so pressed. I've got so much going on. I run into myself coming and going. If I just had more time, you know what? One of the reasons why relationships are so difficult is because relationships require what? They require time. It's easier to do the experience thing than it is to do the relational thing because relationships require time. Look at Deuteronomy chapter 11. God is giving his instructions to the parents in the nation of Israel, and he's told them to put into practice the things that they've learned and then teach these to their children. And notice how he says it starting in verse 18 of chapter 11. He says, "Fix these words of mine in your hearts and minds, tie them as symbols on your hands and bind them on your foreheads." Now, it's interesting that he starts out talking to parents about parents. He says, first of all, you have to have these truths or these principles about me and about life. You've got to have them on the inside. You've got to have them in your heart, and you've got to have them in your mind. They've got to be in here. He says, but then you also have to take them to the outside. You need to bind them on your hands and on your head. You need to take them outside. So it's an internal and an external faith. It's an internal and an external maturity. How do you gain that kind of maturity? It means as a parent that you've got to spend time in spiritual growth. You've got to spend time with God. You've got to spend some time in prayer. You've got to invest some time in the Word. You've got to invest some time in listening and learning from other believers that could help you grow. You've got to invest in your relationship with God in order to have something to offer relationally to your kids. It requires an investment of time. Secondly, he goes on then to the children. He says in verse 19, teach them to your children. So that now requires a commitment to take what God is doing in your mind and what God is teaching you and then transfer it to the kids. And if you're going to transfer it to the kids, you've got to think about, how do I communicate this? How do I teach this? And then he gives the environment for that. He says, teach them to your children, talking about them when you sit at your home, when you walk along the road, when you lie down, and when you get up. So when you're home, when you're traveling, when you're sitting, when you're standing, at night, in the morning, this is intended to communicate basically all the time, you're supposed to be teaching or communicating these truths and these principles in the real life experiences of your kids and in your real life as you go through your day and your time. And he says, Write them on the door frames of your house and on your gates, so that your days and the days of your children may be many in the land that the Lord swore to give your forefathers, as many as the days that the heavens are above the earth. So the promise is that when you live these things and communicate them and pass them on to the next generation, then they're going to get them and they're going to pass them on to the next generation. And the benefit of that is going to be health, blessing, security, maturity, spiritual growth, connection with God, healthy relationships. That's all what comes from this. But that requires time. Now, a number of years ago, a great debate erupted among American parenting experts. And the debate was between the concept of quality time versus quantity time. The old school was spend a lot of time with your kids, be around them as much as you can, do things with them together as a family, frequently unstructured, just do life together, live life together. And in the course of that, you'll have opportunities to teach. Well, there were others that came back and said, you know, the amount of time you spend together is not that important. It's that if you spend some structured time doing some really, really important things, that's what's really important. Well, after experimenting with this for a number of years, the experts have come back to say, you know what you really need? You need a quantity of quality time. Because children cannot be scheduled. Their questions, their fears, their problems. You know, when Johnny comes running in and says, all the kids were teasing me out in the yard, and I'm just a big idiot, and everybody knows that I flunked second grade, and nobody likes me, and I'm just an idiot. You say, well, Johnny, you know, right now we've got some other things that we've got to get done, but a week from Tuesday, we have a family night scheduled. I will put that on the agenda, and we'll discuss it then. You can't do that with children. When they have a question, you better be prepared to answer it. And when they want to talk, especially teenagers, wise parents, you drop what you're doing. And if you never have time to drop what you're doing, because they know that you're in a blur of activities, even the ones for their benefit, you're going to miss opportunities. Wise man told me once that when your kids are little, you'll put them to bed. When they become teenagers, they'll put you to bed. You know, when my 18-year-old comes in to have a philosophical discussion about God and life, about things like homosexuality, about things like Spinoza, about things like girls, it's usually about 10:30 in the evening when there's about this much left of me. And I can either stop and talk to him, or I can just let it go and miss an opportunity. It takes time. Is there any time available in the life that you've built for your kids just to be together as a family? You know, as I was reading this book, The Overscheduled Child, going through it, I was really frustrated because the whole book is about the problem, and when it gets to the solution, there's about five pages. Like five pages out of 240 pages are dedicated to the solution. And as I meditated on what they were doing here, you know what I came to understand? The reason why there's only five pages is because the issues are not hard to understand. The solution is not hard to understand. It's just hard to do. Things like limit your activities. That's hard to do. Son, we've done back-to-back sports for 3 years now, season after season after season. We're going to take this one off. But I may lose my place on the select team. Yeah? You may lose your relationship with your dad if you don't spend any time with me, which is going to be the most important. You got to make some hard decisions. It's saying, you know what, as a family, we're going to spend time together. And the things that we're going to pick to do don't all involve a picture tube. They don't all involve some kind of circuitry or some kind of projection screen where we just sit and face forward. Those are the things that we know. We know how to spend the time. We just got to make the tough decisions to do it. Second reason why relationships are hard is because relationships are messy. Relationships are messy. I mean, let's face it. It is difficult to get involved with those who need the kind of input and feedback and encouragement and help that our children do. It's much easier to turn on VeggieTales when they're cranky than it is to deal with crankiness. It's much easier. Well, let me just be vulnerable with you guys. This is my experience. I don't know if you guys ever had this experience, but so I got my four kids and we're in the car and we're going out to dinner. So we're all piled in there. We're going out to dinner. And I'm not real into spending money anyway. Some would call me tight. And so I kind of feel like that if we're going to go do something special and spend some money, that people ought to be thankful and have a good attitude about that. And so, you know, we're driving, and one of the kids says, well, where are we going? And I said, well, you know, we're going uptown. Man, this is big time. We're going to Cheddar's. Man, we're going to spend some big bucks. Well, I don't like Cheddar's. I want to go to Chili's. Well, I don't want to go to Chili's or Cheddar's. I want to get a salad. They got this great Asian salad at Payway. Teenagers eating salads? What's wrong with our culture? It's about a good old burger. They're cheap. Like me. And see, at that moment, there's something that's just going off in my head. What's going off in my head is, turn the car around. If these kids are not thankful, then we need to go eat leftovers. Because that's going to teach them to be thankful for special things. And then I'm thinking, I don't want to eat leftovers. You know, and then Cindy might want me to help clean the kitchen. It's just so easy to stay out of the messiness of dealing with those attitudes and pull the car in and get food. And some of you guys are better than me, I guess, on that, because you'll go to each of the different places so that all the kids get what they want. It's just so easy to do that than it is to deal with the attitudes. Does that help our kids? Interesting study. The National Council on Addiction and Substance Abuse did a study on hands-on and hands-off parenting. The findings were very interesting. They looked at hands-on parenting and hands-off parenting and found that only 1 in 4 teens live in a hands-on parenting style home. 1 in 4. Now here's what they define. Teens living in hands-on households have parents who consistently take 10 or more of the following 12 actions, and here they are really quickly. They monitor their teens, what their teens watch on TV. They monitor what their teens do on the internet. They put restrictions on the CDs they buy. They know where their teens are after school and on weekends. They are told the truth by their teens about where they are really going. It's interesting. They are very aware of their teens' academic performance. They impose a curfew. They make clear that they would be extremely upset if their teen used pot. They eat dinner with their teens 6 or 7 nights a week, turn off the TV during dinner, assign their teens regular chores, and have an adult present with the teen when the teens return home from school. Now that is 10 out of 12 of those. If you got 10 out of 12 of those, you would qualify, according to the study, to be a hands-on parent. Okay? Only 1/4 of you are. I'd be a hands-on parent. Now, they were studying to see if people abused drugs or alcohol in those various environments, but that was not the interesting thing that came out of the study. Here's what was interesting. The survey found that despite conventional wisdom that many teens don't want their parents to establish rules and expectations, 47% of teens living in hands-on households reported having an excellent relationship with their father, and 57% reported an excellent relationship with their mother. However, only 13% of the hands-off teens reported an excellent relationship with their father, and 24% reported an excellent relationship with their mother. In other words, the more the parents got involved in the messy world of their teens' lives, to know what they were doing and to care what they were doing, and to gather the family together, to work together, to do chores together, to eat together, to spend time with together, to talk about what they're doing academically, to talk about where they're going and who they're hanging out with, those teens found a much greater friendship, relationship, satisfaction with their parents than the parents who said, hey, you know, I trust you. Go do what you want to do. It's your life. Have fun. Click, 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 click. Need some money? Isn't that interesting? So our kids are telling us, hey, Dad, get out of my business. But you know what? In the core of their being, what they're wanting is you to be in their business, because that means you care. To get involved in the messiness of their lives. I want to close this series with one more passage of Scripture. So turn to Romans chapter 5. Romans chapter 5. You know, God is the ultimate parent. And He parents us in the messiness of our lives by getting involved and bringing us into a relationship with Him. Look at Romans 5, starting in verse 6. It says, you see, just at the right time when we were still powerless, Christ died for the ungodly. Very rarely will anyone die for a righteous man, though for a good man some might possibly dare to die. But God demonstrates His own love for us in this. While we were still sinners, Christ died for us. Since we have now been justified by His blood, how much more shall we be saved from God's wrath through Him? For if when we were God's enemies, we were reconciled to Him through the death of His Son, how much more, having been reconciled, shall we be saved through His life? And not only is this so, but we also rejoice in God through our Lord Jesus Christ, through whom we have now received reconciliation. The word reconciliation means the restored relationship. It means to be brought back into peace with God, into relationship with God. And even when we, God's children, had wandered off and defaced the very presence of God in our lives through sin, God got involved. He sent His Son, Jesus, to die for us, to pay for our sins, to draw us, to reconcile us back to Himself. And that is the model for parenting, that we would sacrifice ourselves to meet and find our kids, to get involved in the messiness of immaturity, of the foolishness of their lives, to get to know them personally, meet them where they are, and invest deeply. As we think about this, I want us to spend some time just pausing to meditate on what God our Father has done for us. And we're going to do that through receiving communion. So if you'll bow your heads while the servers go prepare communion, while the worship team makes their way to the stage, just bow your head right now. And I want you to prepare your heart by recognizing that God has come to meet you in Jesus Christ, to build a relationship with you because of His great love for you. Let's just bow our heads and prepare our hearts.